program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from stateconstitutions.us, committed to empowering people of every state by providing the complete text and audio of their state constitutions. Those seeking to hold state governments accountable can learn more at stateconstitutions.us. KBOO program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members in a grant from B-Space Movement and Expressive Arts Studio, hosting the Life, Art, Being Integrative Arts Festival, a week of practicing presence with the self, the body, and earth, July 7th through the 12th at B-Space and Portland Shambhala Center. Life, Art, Being includes authentic movement, Shambhala art, deep ecology practices, and more. Information can be found at dashspace.org/lifeartbeing.
Tune in Saturday, June 28th for a live broadcast from Good in the Hood. KBOO will broadcast the entertainment from Lillis Albina Park from 2 to 7 p.m. Tune in to hear what's good in the hood Saturday, June 28th from 2 to 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. KBOO is proud to co-sponsor and broadcast live from the 2014 Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. The 27th annual festival will take place July 3rd through the 6th, 2014, at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. It will feature Greg Allman, Los Lobos, Lee Fields, and The Expressions among the 100-plus acts that will perform over the four-day festival. The 27th annual Waterfront Blues Festival will benefit the Oregon Food Bank. More information on artists, tickets, and the KBOO broadcast of the festival can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, I'm Celeste Carey.
And I'm Cecil Prescott.
Join us this coming Monday for More Talk Radio, when our guest will be Shayna Redmond, author of Anthem, Social Movements and the Sound of Solidarity in the African Diaspora.
We'll talk about how black music has contributed to the growth and mobilization of the modern black citizen.
That's More Talk Radio, Monday, June 30th at 8 a.m. right here on KBOO Portland.
City of the Dead. No, it's not Halloween. It's just me. This is a Clash tune. It's good. We're going to talk about urban history, and we're going to talk about the government of Portland, and we're going to talk about what is to be done about all kinds of problems that the city has, and we're going to hear from you, because this is talk radio. This is Positively Revolting. I'm sitting in for the incredible team that normally does this show, and I'm a little intimidated, and I'll tell you why. It is a show that traditionally has been run by, I'd say even four women. And here's this guy walking in here for the summer, just kind of covering the show. And what do I know? Not a lot. So I need your help. I need you to call. I'm particularly interested in hearing from women. That's not a rule. I'm not going to make it a rule. But, you know, one of the things I've noticed doing talk radio at KBOO is we have a lot of the regular voices, very often very good, very wise, very critical. On the other hand, I'll bet there's a lot of people who'd like to get in. We don't have a very primitive system of phones here. And that means that it's not easy to stack up calls the way you would on a commercial radio station. So you got to help us by putting your voice on the air and by being kind of concise in what you want to say. And certainly being critical of anything I might say or somebody else might say. This is KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. This is Talk Radio. This is me, Joe Uris. And this is Traditionally Positively Revolting, a great show on Fridays. are you ready for better city government? Yeah, well, are you a little bit tired? You know, recently we've had a couple of measures that put the fear of God in me. The first was an attempt to put trash fluoride, this is my position, into our water supply, giving everybody fluoride and helping people's teeth who need that help. It didn't seem like an efficient plan. It seemed like a relatively totalitarian plan because as I investigated it with some medical doctors and many persons who have issues, health issues, the plan was draconian. And so I was one of those who opposed it, even though I do believe that fluoride should be applied topically to the teeth, particularly of children. Now, that was the first, what do you want to call it, shoe that dropped. The next was a plan by an independent group who I felt were totally under the influence of the water bottling industry and the people who make various parts for electronic stuff, you know, that wanted to change, that actually wanted to change the way in which the city's water and sewer system is run and who would run it. They wanted to create a separate board elected locally by district. It was a faulty plan, and it doesn't really address so many of the problems that I see coming out of the water situation. And I think I really angered a lot of progressives by being one of those, if it was noticed at all, that thought it was a bad idea and opposed it. And I wasn't happy with that. I wanted to see if we couldn't have a conversation, not about water. I want to be clear about this. Not specifically about water or fluoride, but rather about city governance. And in order to do that, being sort of an academic kind of jerk myself, I thought I'd start with a conversation with you about the history of the American city. It's very different than many parts of the world. And it is founded from, you know, a long time ago in American history. So I thought I'd start out with conversation about that and about the forms of city government and what exactly is the form that dominates Portland. And we'd go from there. So let's start out with that. And if you get real bored, call me. The number to call, 231-8187, and you can certainly do that anytime. We'll try to stack up the calls in the order received. Again, we're looking, because it's too rare for me, for women callers. That's not a rule, but it's a desire. Won't you give us a call here at KBOO? So, cities. Oh, my. Cities. First of all, you've got to understand that the original models of cities didn't exist so much in the South as they did in New England. And in New England, many of those cities were self-managed based on a religious model of democracy. Town hall meetings evolved out of that, and a kind of model that you still see in smaller towns in New England where everybody gets together once or twice or more per year en masse to make decisions regarding the city government. That works when you have a relatively small town. It doesn't work when you have giant cities. In the beginnings of the giant city foundations, the beginning of all of that, cities like New York, eventually cities like Chicago, or all the way to the West Coast, were cities dominated at least informally and sometimes structurally by somebody who could be called a boss. Always a guy who essentially rewarded people who were loyal and brought him power, helped him to get elected, etc., by giving them jobs, often jobs that were superfluous or easier to do, essentially putting the city's bureaucracies under the rewards that come with political favors. Now, that form of government existed in most part of the country. And, of course, the other part of that was that the big manufacturers, the large mining firms, the huge companies that wanted those cities to exist in their interest dominated. They had the money, they had the power, and they pushed for it. And if you're interested in city governance as an issue, there's lots of stuff. Lincoln Stevens book, all kinds of stuff on city history. The big modern city movement really happens with the Progressive Era, which is an era that begins in the late 1800s, and it goes all into the 1920s. And this was a period of time when city governments were reevaluated and rethought of. Let's talk about that a little bit. First of all, in 1900, there was a horrendous hurricane. I don't know if you know Texas at all, but in southern Texas, the city of Galveston was on a spit, essentially, across from the mainland, and it was wiped out. And that gave an opportunity to the various progressive elements to try to evolve a different kind of city government. And what they came up with is essentially the plan similar to Portland. Now, there were three or four kinds of organizations for city government. And they're really important. There are cities like New York and Chicago which have huge city councils or city assemblies which are elected by district. So each neighborhood conceivably would have its own representative. And then the mayor would be the executive who would run the various branches of that city government under the ruling or decisions of that huge city council. Frequently, it was a very large number of people. And it's still the case, pardon me, in New York and other places. Now, within that model, and this is where we have to think about things, mayors became incredibly powerful. Because they could dispense largesse, because they could give people jobs, even jobs that didn't really involve any work, or take those away, patronage, pardon me, became very, very important. When the hurricane happened in Galveston, the city was pretty much wiped out, and there began to be interest, particularly by the movements of the progressives, to consider a new kind of city government. And basically three models evolved. The first one, which is Galveston's model, is very much like our own. An at-large, small city council, and when I say at-large, that means it doesn't represent particular areas of the city. It represents the city as a whole, which has certain disadvantages, among which is that it means that the dominant political class and the wealthy can pretty much dominate those elections with a mayor. Now, in Portland, that mayor and our system is called the weak mayor system. Here's what happens. We elect a city council, a relatively small number of individuals elected at large from the whole city. Most of us don't know these people. Most of us only know the huge amounts of money that are put into those campaigns. We're kind of picking spinning in the dark. And rarely do we get much progressive force involved. There are progressives who run, but they don't generally win. The mayor under that system, who's also elected at large, has no more special powers than any of the other city council members, except that he or she can choose which bureaus these city councilmen, known as commissioners, will have. So the mayor can giveth and taketh away the police department or the water bureau or the sewer bureau or the roads, you know, various responsibilities which are supposedly run by these specific council members. If you ever go down to City Hall and you look around, you'll see that the city council members are called commissioners and they have specific assignments. And each year, the mayor chooses who will have which assignments based on their lobbying, how good and in line with the mayor their ideas are or aren't. And this is the only power, the only special power that the mayor has within the city council. Now, in other cities, there are, as I said, the model like New York or Chicago, where there's a large assembly representing individual neighborhoods, which is a voting body, a legislature, if you will, for the city, which gives direction to the mayor. The mayor's job is to administer this vast empire. And in a place like New York, it's huge. The money available is huge. The responsibilities are huge. The impact on population is huge. The other model is called the small council city manager model. And this is what I think Astoria still has. And what basically that is there's a small legislative group who make the rules, who pass the ordinances. There's a mayor. But most significantly, that city government hires a city manager who's a bureaucrat, an administrator, who carries out the direction of the city and often will present a city plan to the council for approval. The problem with that, and there are many, but the main problem is that this is a path to a successful career. So you might start out as the city manager podunk, and hopefully you'd be looking for the next job in the next larger district or area, the area of pedunk, and so on until you got to the top of the whole class of city manager managed cities. There's also other kinds of problems. There's no real accountability often for city councils. They do what they do, and we respond to them. Recently in Portland, for example, decisions have been made which will adversely affect the not crippled enough crowd. They will have to pay for their parking. This is in response to a reality, which is there is a lot of crippled people passes, of handicap passes that have been given out within Oregon. And those people have an enormous advantage in parking. And many merchants find parking places clogged in the city, which adversely impacts their ability to make money. So just one example. Then there's that whole question of who, for example, is responsible for the Water Bureau. And to what degree are they experts? And who are the people they hire? And what kind of second guessing or checks and balances, if you will, do we as citizens have? And I'm going to argue that the really only way to deal with the situation, if you're unhappy with city government, and I am, and many others are, I've had times when I thought we had a pretty good council and times when I thought, yeah, and I'm not saying which this is, but the way to respond to that, that seems to me to be the only way, is to begin a long-term campaign to elect people who are progressive and who fit the bill in your terms of your own interests. So we should talk about city government. We should talk about the excesses of it. For example, right now, just so you probably know this, but right now there is going to be a tax on your on every year. It's a head tax, and that head tax will be supposedly, but it's unclear when it begins and how long it lasts and when it ends, if it ever ends, that will be for fixing up the streets, which have potholes and have been neglected for other kinds of projects, creating sidewalks, in general, creating more of a cityscape in areas that have been neglected in the southeast, in the southwest, in the northeast, and the north. So that's something that is going to be done, maybe, it's very unclear, but it's a decision of the city council. It is not necessarily one you or I get to vote on, although we can force a referendum on it. Now, in addition to that one is a tax, another head tax. By the way, in case you're wondering, a head tax means for individual, not based on income or ability to pay, but rather based as a flat tax. So everybody in Portland is supposed to pay for arts. And the arts money mainly goes to institutions that already exist. And this is $35 a piece? Not so bad, huh? Well, yeah, it's the nickel and dime impact. You got a fee of 100 and something per year that you're supposed to pay for the roads that you thought were being paid for by your regular city taxes. And then on top of that, you got an arts tax, and you and I might well not agree on what kind of art is the tax is legitimately taxed. I might feel, for example, that those strange metal structures that are at the ends of several of the bridges on the east side are silly and ugly and functionless, but I have a plan for them, by the way. I think homeless people ought to slip in there in the dark of night and create apartments out of those powerful hard steel objects and just have people living. They can put their tents on a floor that they build there. Wouldn't that be weird? I think it'd be kind of cool as long as it's safe. Anyway, I am interested in hearing from you, specifically from you, about how you think the city ought to be run, how you think things are going now, and what you think about the situation in general here in urban Portland. So do we have a caller? Wanda! Hi. Hello? Whoop. She's gone. Oh, well. Okay. All right. I happen to be a person who's very lucky in that I got to write about urban vice in the 1950s in Portland, Oregon, for my PhD dissertation. It was kind of cool. I discovered a lot about how the city was run up until the expose, which took place in a Pulitzer Prize-winning story in the Oregonian and an oppositional set of stories in the then Oregon Journal. Now, those of you who are old enough will remember that at that time, prior to the kicking out of the labor unions in the newspaper business in Portland, there was a morning paper, the Oregonian, which was very conservative and Republican, and not reactionary like Republicans today, but conservative and Republican. And there was a more or less independent, say, Democratic Party-oriented newspaper in the afternoon called the Oregon Journal. The Oregonian was the big paper, and it was eventually sold out of the hands of local people and sold to the Newhouses, who control it to this day. At the time of the strike, and this is really important to all of this, at the time of the strike, deals went down such that eventually the afternoon paper, which was not so profitable, would lose its local ownership and would be bought by the Oregonian people, and within a certain number of years would be disappeared entirely to make way for a single paper, the Oregonian. When the newspaper strike took place and was lost by the workers in the various organized labor groups that work in newspapers, a new paper was briefly created. A new paper was created called The Reporter, and it lasted for a few years but couldn't gather enough advertising revenue. It was an afternoon paper and couldn't really survive. So now we had, for many years, a single newspaper dominating the city. But recently, publications like Willamette Week, The Mercury, The Tribune, and others have appeared to challenge the hegemony of the single newspaper. And the newspaper itself has decided that it would be more profitable to virtually disappear itself, to go online, and to create a very minimal kind of newspaper, which has only one advantage from my point of view. The comics are now in color. I want to hear from you, Wanda. You're on the air.
I am. Hello.
Hi, this is Joe. What's up?
Yes, hello. I have an idea. Maybe for Freedom Summer?
Freedom Summer. Go for it.
Well, it's really great to hear you tackle this topic, and thus far it's been enlightening. I will do your reading and some more research, but we should have civic studies, discussions.
Civics studies?
Yeah, to let people know, you know, that they've got a city hall and just how accessible it is. It's not very accessible. It's really hard to crack, to understand mm-hmm. how things are run the way they are. I mean, I think it would be good to have the reading, but also some discussions, and then to get into the agenda items, the audit reports. Oh, mm-hmm. those are the best. I would really like it if our city had an auditor.
Well, it does.
An area where the citizens could have some input on what the auditor does. The auditor has been doing some good work, and I hope the next person who's elected continues, but there's no checks and balances on it. That's one area we should focus on, as well as the one you suggested about putting out candidates. But if we started having conversations regularly, mm-hmm. maybe this summer, we could get people interested. A lot of people have been turned off, and it's intimidating to go in there. In many ways, because I've been going for a long time, But the commissioners, definitely, their staff, very off-putting. And the security guards, people with guns that are, they do, at any rate. It would be nice to have it on the tables and chairs. They now have tables and chairs out front of the city hall that they have presumed, they lock them up until the food carts arrive. And the food carts were brought in to scare away the homeless, well, the homeless vigil, because the homeless were pushed off the sidewalk earlier, but they kept a vigil there, which I continue to keep going. I used to be a KABU reporter at City Hall, and I was so confused by the Wednesday council meetings that I thought I would just keep going and try to figure it out for myself. If I could attend every Wednesday, surely I would understand what was going on at City Hall.
How'd that work for you?
It's been years. And there are budgets, there are pet projects, there are levies, grants, things that don't even go in the budget. They just come up in the city council meeting for the first time that you've ever heard of it. And you wonder what kind of private meetings are going on the side. So there are some public meetings that you can watch on cable access or on the website, and you can peruse the website, but it's all very confusing, and we really need to find a way to make this accessible, just a curriculum for the average citizen to become an activist.
Well, I think that's a great idea. No, I really think it's a good idea. I don't know how you'd instrumentalize. I don't know how you'd make that happen, but it's a great idea.
And I know smaller towns that work very... I mean, a smaller town, it's easier to follow. And like you're saying, there are different forms of government. But I think Portland is a bit chaotic.
Well, I think the model here is, as I tried to suggest, a little bit out of the Texas disaster, the post-hurricane disaster in Galveston. It's a model for, I think, a smaller city. And because the council members are elected at large, it's very hard for ethnic communities or interest groups or class-based groups to gain a share of the power, because it takes a lot of money and a lot of influence and a lot of who-you-know-ness to get yourself a situation where you can really get on the city council.
Did you notice how many police were present at the town hall on street fees?
I wasn't there. Oh, I hate to admit that. I wasn't there. So, no, I didn't.
Well, it's just funny because the mayor, for quite some time now, you see them at the big conferences in the keynote address or traveling here and there. Same with the chief going to the chief of police going to Bangladesh or D.C. on a whim. And then they show up to city council, but there aren't meetings you can have with them. As a group, you really have to advocate constantly, like R2-D2 does. And you notice it's always usually Amanda Fritz that's open. Steve Novick a little bit, but you never see Nick Fish or Dan Saltzman at community events, you know, the small grassroots community events like at, say, NIA or, funnily enough, because they deal with children, the Center for Intercultural Organizing, you know, immigrant events. I would like to see their faces, and so you could actually come up and approach them, but they're unapproachable.
Well, I'm sure they would feel that they are approachable, but more important than that, and I think your point is really valid, they don't have any reason to fear. Once you're an elected candidate, once you're a person who is in the position of city council member, you get to stay there because you'll be supported by the business community and others who have an interest in such things. You'll get to stay there and get reelected endlessly unless some vast movement develops to replace you, and that doesn't happen too often. And I think what you're observing is an insider community, almost a crony system that dominates City Hall. Not that the candidates, not that the people who are in those offices are necessarily evil or reactionary, although we could argue that, but more that they dominate without any fear that there's a repercussion in their political lives. Yeah. Thank you anyway for the call. I think it's an important call. I want to hear from people on city government, on your ideas for changing it, making it better, criticizing it, talking about your experiences with it, and generally thinking about the history of cities and how they've evolved and where they've gone. And I want to be clear that the research I did about the 1950s showed that parallel to the formal city government, there was a whole system of paybacks, police getting getting money, kickback money, of essentially when the black community developed as a significant force, a system which essentially kept that black community out of the political center, but was managed and controlled by certain guys, certain men who were in the black community who had access to real estate and to money from various criminal enterprises. It kind of like a little bit like the television show Atlantic City. And I don't I think that it's kind of hard to say that the city is like that today, mainly because the ethnic makeup of the city council looks a little white to me. So I want to hear from you. I also want to point out, and we haven't really gone there at all, that this state and this city have really not been very friendly in their histories to ethnic minorities, particularly to African Americans. And this is part of the issue. The question of power here has more to do with whether you're a significant force in industry or commerce or commercial endeavors, or whether you're just somebody who works for a living, if you're lucky. 231-8187, talking about cities, wanting to hear from you. Vernon, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
First, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for becoming positive revolting, because my Fridays have improved considerably.
Oh, well, okay. Thank you.
And I also want to point out a chunk in the Oregon Constitution that I don't think anyone's ever taken advantage of, but it's a very unique thing.
Tell us about
Oregon. Specifically allows local governments to be run through proportional representation.
Really? I didn't know that.
It is written right into the Constitution that a local government may charter itself to use proportional representation. And I think that would be a massive improvement.
Well, how would that work? How would that
representation
work?
Of minorities. We could have true deliberation where everyone's point of view was heard. I think that the opportunity is too good to let pass.
I didn't know about that. I think that's a very interesting idea. I'm kind of a mild advocate for a slate of candidates who are progressive. Not any particular slate that exists, but just the concept of it. I think it's time that there was a little bit of a shakeup, and concerned, knowledgeable progressives took some power in City Hall. And there hasn't been that kind of interest, even by establishment progressives, since the days of, we don't speak of him well anymore, Neil Goldschmidt.
Well, I'm sure you're aware of the problem with majority rule is that good ideas very rarely flow from the majority.
Well, I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's certainly the case the majority, when it rules, can be dictatorial or eliminate any kind of minority argument that may have great validity.
And good ideas generally come from a small faction. They're often recognized by the others when they're truly good solutions, but they usually come from a smaller faction, and if that faction has no voice in your government, they go unheard.
Well, and it's certainly true that both symbolically and actually, minorities are poorly represented on city council. The pattern that I have seen is that there has been usually the ethnic division within city council is not considered important. Yet, there's frequently a city council person who religiously is Jewish. Frequently, there is a city council person, at least one, who is a woman. Not to make equivalence between those two, but the fact is that we haven't.
Women are actually a majority, I believe.
Yeah, you're right. And actually, interestingly enough, we haven't had a African American on city council for a great period of time, a long period of time. And I want to be clear about this: the fact that someone is Jewish or Catholic or ethnically black or whatever doesn't mean they're going to be great. It doesn't mean they're going to necessarily even represent the interests of that community. It doesn't even mean that community has a solid interest. But it is an opportunity for a little bit of diversity, which we really sorely lack. Anyway, I want to thank you for your call, and I want to thank you for thanking me.
All right.
Hey, take it easy. But take it. 231-8187. We're talking about city governance. We're talking about the history of city government in the United States. We're talking about corruption, and we're talking about the possibilities of improvement. We're also peripherally dealing with the fact that recently we've had a head tax proposed, which is probably going to happen in the fall, which will cost us $100 to do what you think the ordinary city government taxation ought to do, which is to repair the streets, to finish the streets that are unfinished, to put sidewalks in, to put streetlights in, to put signals in, all these things that need to be done that have been kind of delayed or deferred in the city as we've gone on to do other things that probably a lot of people who listen to the station would love, like bike lanes and so on. And the question is, what comes first, what's most important, and so on. And recently, of course, we had a measure to try to pry the Water Bureau and the Sewer Bureau away from the hands of the City Council, which failed. So I want to hear from you on your thinking about city government in Portland, Oregon, and anywhere else. 231-8187. Aaron.
Hi.
Hi.
I actually proposed this idea before when you had a time slot opening up and you're trying, and the host was asking people what they wanted put in that time slot.
Uh-huh.
Most of us get our information from KABU. A lot of us.
Oh my God! Really?
So why isn't there a 1 hour time slot, a couple times a week, that is devoted specifically to organizing and changing our government?
Interesting. Well, hold on. I'm going to let you finish, but I just wanted to comment on that. That's an interesting idea, and I think it's one that you might want to, since you're talking about cable, you might want to take to the programming committee. But go ahead.
But this is where our minds gather anyways. It is the natural place for something like this to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little resistance to the idea and also support of it, but it just never happened, and I know I can't because I'm working 50 hours a week just to try and pay my bills.
Right. That's the main way that we're all controlled. That is that we've got to make the nut and we don't have time to do other stuff.
Although I recently changed so I actually could open up some time that I could devote to something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I really feel that is the best way to actually make some kind of change is to organize through KABU over the air, have callers call in and say, hey, I could do this. I could support in this way. And then you're like, okay, well, here, I'll put you back to the engineer who will get your information and we'll make that happen.
Okay,
and
now you do remember, you do know that one of the things we can't do is become a political party or organization actively supporting a particular set of candidates without opportunity to the other sides or side. But yeah, I think your idea is very interesting. I think a study
what
of...
What is that limitation?
I'm not sure. It has to do with the fact that we're a nonprofit and that we are not allowed to become an advocacy group for any particular political side, although we are progressive.
Could you offer a time slot to a side?
I think a time slot could happen, and I think it would be interesting, and I think we would want someone to run that who is even-handed and open-minded and willing to allow a lot of discussion. I think one of the things that I really think is important and would revitalize KABU would be if we were more involved in local politics, particularly city and county politics. Now, we're not allowed, and this is the rules that we live under, to advocate for specific candidates for specific positions. We are allowed to make comment and suggestions and reactions to proposed ordinances or changes in the rules or, for example, the reorganization of the city water and sewer bureaus.
So would it be possible or allowed through that to allow candidates themselves to host a show? And so you get different candidates hosting different times of the week.
I don't think you can do that, but I think one of the things that we need to do, and it's a difficult thing to do, is to open up forums for people who want to run for office, making sure that everyone has an opportunity. One of the problems, and quite honestly, that one finds is that if you say, okay, everybody running for mayor can have 15 minutes, let's arbitrarily say, on the air, you'll end up, there could be 10 candidates. Now, that's 2.5, something like that, hours. And it's going to be something people just aren't going to be able to listen to.
Well, maybe not for mayor, but for, like, city council, if you have, like, slot number one, slot number two, slot number three, different days of the week, you could limit the number of candidates that would want to talk in that way. And I think if you were to, like, have people call in questions and give, like, a couple of different people a chance to answer, then we could actually get something rolling so that we could replace all the smaller positions. Maybe we can't elect a mayor, but we could certainly load him up with a council that he doesn't want to deal with.
Okay, but just remember that the mayor, that's interesting. We just remember that the mayor and the council members are all elected at large, which means essentially the same number of voters are voting for each council member and the mayor. The only special power the mayor really has is the ability to take away or give bureaus to various members of the city council.
Well, I saw a lot of empty slots on my last ballot. A lot of positions which didn't even have a candidate in it. And I think we can load those up.
Okay. I'm not sure what you're referring to, but okay. I mean, because the city council is just the city council. There is a lot of smaller offices within the county. There's the water, the environmental water group. I can't remember its name. There are a lot of little positions. And then, of course, there's on top of that, or overseeing that, or next to that, is the county government, which is quite different in its management. Anyway, I'm going to let you go give others an opportunity.
Can I just say one more thing?
Sure.
There was, I saw this on the Young Turks a while ago. There was a 19-year-old who was elected to some position of government, and he was literally the only one who voted for himself. No one else is running. He wrote his name on the ballot. He voted for himself. He won.
Where was this?
I don't remember where. It was on the Young Turks on YouTube, on their channel. It's right there.
Oh, yeah.
And he chose to run as a Republican, and he got himself sworn in on the Quran.
Whoa.
It was beautiful.
That's pretty cool.
Anyways, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. 231-8187. We're talking about urban government. We're talking about the city of Portland specifically. We're talking about what needs to be done, or are you all happy with it? Are you happy with your city council? it's an insider group. It's not I don't consider it a particularly bad council. I think it is, my personal criticisms include the fact that I'm very concerned about management of basic services. I'm very upset when monies are used to do things that the city ought to do within the budget that exists, and instead they're doing other adventurous projects, which I like, but which maybe should come after the basic services. And I wonder what you think. 231-8187. Ralph, you're on the air.
Hey, Joe.
Hey.
I got a couple points. People should read about how crazy Portland was, way back in the day.
Well, yeah, it was pretty corrupt.
Yeah, I mean, there was a brothel in the middle of the Willamette River that they would tow to one side of the river or the other, depending on which place the police were raiding.
Oh, okay, I'm glad you said that, because I was afraid it was like aquatic sex. Anyway, go ahead.
But I think what we have now is what I'm calling the construction mafia. Or you can call it the developer mafia.
What do you mean?
What I mean is that they have so much money to throw around at the political class, mm-hmm, that they pretty much control who gets on the board, and all the people who get on the commission and the mayor, mm-hmm, are doing the bidding of the construction, engineering, banking industries that are here. And so what they get is they get tax-free zones put up, they get urban renewal districts, mm-hmm, for areas that aren't anywhere near poverty, need to be torn down, and then they can build all these new buildings and get all sorts of breaks. And the reason that they don't have any money is for all these pet projects they've been doing over the years. And so you take a guy like Dan Saltzman, who's been on there for years, right? And you think, well, he comes from one of the richest families in Portland. You know, why does he want to spend all his time down at City Hall? And I call him the third man. He's the third man because the votes come down to a 3-2 vote, right? If you get three votes, it carries. So whatever side they want, he's the third man. And you know, it's a very corrupt system, but now they've managed to all make it gobbledygook legal. You know, they're not doing prostitution. They're not doing, as far as we know, you know, running the drug trade, gambling.
Well, I think we can safely say they're not doing either of those. But go ahead.
No. But I mean, there's a ton of money in government handouts and tax abatements, in putting up, you know, getting development blocks and then renting them out. I mean, Dan Saltzman is, I think, still in the process of turning or leasing one of his buildings downtown over for Metro's thinking of moving downtown, or no, it's TriMet, I guess. And TriMet's bankrupt because they've spent their money unwisely on all this light rail development. And again, I ride light rail every day, but you have to do it prudently. And now they want us to vote on a basic service that should be just part of the budget. Why don't we have a vote, a head tax vote for pet projects? And like you said, we might even not get the vote on this. So, you know, one of the things you were talking about last week of kind of that, you know, things are really messed up. What do we do? I think the best thing we can do is to start peeling back the onion, the layers, start exposing what's really going on so that, okay, we might not be able to beat them because of now money controls everything. But we might be able to expose them and to show how everything works. And just because it's legal doesn't mean that it's good for you.
I appreciate that. I want to give others an opportunity then.
All right.
Thank you for the call. 231-8187. We're talking about the problems of urban Portland. We're talking about urban history in the region. A couple of things were referred to. One of them is tax increment financing. I just wanted to explain that one. The Portland Development Commission was created in the late 50s. Essentially, it was an outsider enterprise by large money interests, Ira Keller being the most famous of those folks. It essentially disappeared the old South Portland neighborhood, which was ethnically diverse, largely Jewish, but also Italian, to some degree Rom, that is Gypsy, and Black. And it all got disappeared. The communities moved on. Most of the people involved could afford to move somewhere else, but there was real resistance. And now those ugly high towers and vast spaces, plazas that seem empty and bereft of any quality or character, all of that is the Portland Development Commission. The same thing happened in a variety of neighborhoods. The African American community in Portland was totally disappeared in a project that in the 1970s was created within model cities and elsewhere that promised that we would have a huge medical center in Albina. That money's, Hilburton money's and so on, disappeared. But all the neighborhood, 33 blocks of housing, of which about half was African-American, was disappeared. And the African-American community was largely dispersed. Its cultural centers, its stores and so on went away. And that was done with very little resistance by the ordinary Portlander. I want to hear from you. It's Martha, is it? What? Who's it?
Martha.
Hi, you're on the air.
Joe, thank you. First of all, very good on all of the information that we're getting. Thank you. And I think given that you do have a considerable amount of information in this area, that one show might not be sufficient. And I would like to second the motion of the person who asked for space to be made on the air to have more in-depth discussion about these things, and to comment that the last person who spoke, who talked about the various ways in specific, you know, that the government works, like, you know, who gets what for what and so forth, that these things do be explored. And I understand that as a nonprofit, you cannot run a slate and say this is who we should get.
Right. I can't come on any candidates or slates.
However, far from, you know, leaving just that aside, there is a great deal that is being done every day on KABU to expose at a national level and an international level the corruption of the society we live in. And there is no reason, then, that that cannot be done at the local level, and actually much more reason to do it, because this is where we live and where we're involved and where we have a chance of really making a change and not of hanging out in desperation and despair. So I would like to second the motion of the person and the people who suggest, I think, that we can further the impetus to organize in the sense of more information and having people come on the air who have ideas and who represent the communities which are absolutely not represented in the city council. There was someone running this past time, his name escapes me at the moment, but I know you know who I'm talking about, who was running, I believe, against Dan Saltzman, and who, boy, as soon as I saw his name and saw what he was standing for, he was a professor, I believe, and I said, oh, I'm voting for that guy because look what he's for. All of these things that had to do with supporting the homeless and so forth and so on. Anyway, I don't want to be on the air forever here, but I just want to point out that KABU does so much already and can do so much more in terms of helping us get to know each other. In other words, I'm happy to leave my number and name with the engineer at any time and say, yes, anyone who calls in and says, I want to speak with the person who called in before, give out my name and number.
Well, that's an interesting, you know, we have a kind of a policy not to invade people's privacy and give them the opportunity. Right. But, you know, you can do that. You can leave your name and number at the desk or with the engineer if he or she has time. And I think that really creating dialogue on air or off air, discussing urban problems, which I don't think we do enough, is a great idea. And I want to thank you. I want to move on, but I want to thank you very much.
Sure.
All right. I got to do some business here. I got to tell you that this is what's coming up on KABU this morning at 9 on One Land, Many Voices. We hear Speaker Phyllis Bennis and Josh Rubner speaking on the seeds of justice and hope for Palestinians and Israelis. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints asks, will the 21st century be the Kurdish century? And what's next for Iraq and the rest of the region? And the city of Detroit denies water. This is incredible. Denies water to thousands of its poor and working class residents. And I think the UN is becoming involved in that one. You know, water is a right under the UN Charter. And at 11, the focus is genetically modified foods. A report from Oregon Community Media, a project of independent community radio stations, including us, throughout the state. And I want to thank KABU members for your generous support. Hey, if you're not a member, kind of get it done. Join. Give us whatever you can afford, whether it's $5 million or $5. We really need it, and it helps us keep on the air. Remember, we're nonprofit for real. I ain't paid to do this. None of our other performers, as it were, none of our other hosts, none of our other programmers are paid either. So make this... radio's expensive. Make this project successful and make it more and more effective through your generous contributions. We're talking about urban relations, talking about urban affairs, talking about the city government of Portland, and we're talking about the history of urban studies, and we really want to hear from you. 231-8187. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi. My name is Eric.
Eric, sorry.
First of all, Martha was referring to the candidacy of Nick Caleb, I believe.
Yes, that is the name. I didn't want to... Nick Caleb.
This might be... It's before moving to Portland. I'm calling in from Southeast Portland, the only Portland I ever have known. And I'm watching an amazing amount of large, new construction projects all around the neighborhood that I'm familiar with.
I noticed it on Division Street particularly.
Division Street, on Third, on Cesar Chavez, on everywhere. And not everywhere, all over town. And before moving to Portland, I lived and worked in and around Berkeley, California, where I went to every Berkeley City Council meeting and became somewhat of an expert, because it was part of my job, on how those buildings got argued over. And I have no idea how that works in Portland.
Well, I'm not sure there's much public argument, actually. And that troubles me. You know, one of the changes, two changes that concern me, and I don't know whether they're good or bad. I think one's bad, is the idea, a very idealistic idea, that we're all going to ride bicycles or walk or take public transportation, which would only work if the public transportation was cheap, easy, and everywhere and frequent, which is not the case. And the whole area around Division and other areas, are we're seeing big apartment houses and condos and so on with no garages, no parking spaces allotted specifically to them, which means that the neighborhoods, which often have small single-family houses, are overwhelmed by traffic parking where they can. And this is the best you can hope for it, is it'll look a little bit like, I don't know, Paris or someplace like that, which sounds exotic, but try parking in such a city, or New York.
So what's interesting to me is that I wonder if a sort of NIMBY movement, in especially in that neighborhood of homeowners, could arise to look a lot more like what would happen in Berkeley, where those neighborhoods would they would organize around specific four-story, five-story apartment complexes that were going up on their block.
And, yeah.
You know, in Berkeley, they had a zoning adjustments board that would vote, so that that was a commission that that would debate the shape and nature of a project before it would be approved. And then that decision would go in front of the city council, and that would be another
opportunity, yeah,
for the neighborhood to speak their minds, mostly to obstinate elected officials who would do what they want anyway. But that doesn't happen in Portland.
Well, it doesn't, and it does seem like it's a closed system. And whether it appears as such or is in reality such, it's an interesting conversation that we'll be having off and on over the years. But for sure, there needs to be improvements. I am very concerned with, I mentioned already, these apartment houses and condos where there's no planned parking for the members of that densification community. That's number one. But number two is this now talk about building these tiny apartments. You know, mini, teeny-weeny cubicles for
accessory
people.
Dwelling units. People should learn that dumb jargon, because that's what they call them. Mother-in-law cottages.
Well, that's one aspect, but there's another aspect, which is you'd build a building, I don't know, five-story building perhaps, with teeny apartments and with a shared kitchen and a shared bathroom. And while that's something that can help for people who are without housing, it's a dark future for people who want to perhaps have families, want to have organization, community, and so on.
And one more thing I just want to put into the conversation for people to think about is that it took me a long time to learn this fact. I had to speak to a lot of knowledgeable people who weren't getting their voices heard in what media we had in California on this issue, and I think it relates to Portland in the same way. That older buildings have affordable units, and then the older buildings get bought up and destroyed and turned into new buildings, and those new units go at the market rate, which is considerably higher. So what's happening in Berkeley, and I think it's not happening in Portland, and I bet you there's a feeling that it should be happening, I certainly think it should, is that old buildings should be protected, not just because they look really pretty and they remind us of the history of our city and they add character and, you know, they have value because of the historical value of an old building, but old buildings also provide more affordable floor units than new buildings.
I think your points are good, and I really appreciate the conversation. I want to give others a chance now.
Thank you, sir. I like the show.
Yeah, thank you very much. All right, I think we have barely any time left. Do we have time for another caller?
Yeah,
Let's go for it. Who is it? Oh, secret caller. Hi, secret caller.
Rent control. Yeah, that was good. You were laughing about, oh, yeah, there's no more vice going on like that about prostitution in City Hall.
Yeah. Oh, we lost the lady. I'm sorry. We were going to get into some juicy stuff, and it didn't happen. You know, I want to know how you appreciate my taking over this show, only for the summer. I want to be clear about that. Our great hosts will be returning in the fall, or actually late summer. I'm doing this because two things. A selfish reason. I need more skills. I need to develop more radio skills. I haven't been doing commercial radio in so long. And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, this is an opportunity to talk about some very serious issues in the absence of the regular show, which also talks about very serious issues. And I want to hear from you, suggestions for topics, criticism, and so on. Here's a caller. Charlotte, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to mention that the previous caller who was talking about how the land use development system works, there really is a system in Portland, and the main way to interface with it is to go to your local neighborhood association.
Oh, that's a good
and
point.
They have land use chairs, and of course, there are lots of rules and lots of places you can go and learn more about it by going to the Planning Bureau and reading the documents and going to meetings and stuff. But that's the interface to start getting involved in the land use development system.
I really appreciate that, and you're absolutely right. And that is something that can be tedious, but it's very important. Those meetings of the neighborhood associations frequently develop a certain level of power and influence, which can control behavior by the city council and others, and the bureau people. So I really want to thank you all for this show. We run out of time. I want to urge you all to stay tuned to KBOO. Remember, we fight for you, we fight for the right, and we give you the best news music at the same time.
I'm out to sing songs. It'll prove to you that this is your world. And that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you